The paradigm that we've been hearing about, the mechanistic paradigm, has been dominant for a long time. And one aspect of this paradigm is the idea that the universe is governed by laws, and that these laws are effectively changeless or timeless. If we change from that paradigm to the idea of the paradigm of organism, then we can see the evolutionary universe as something like a developing organism. And instead of thinking of the laws of nature as fixed, true for all time, changeless laws, we might be able to see the laws of nature as more like habits. Now, these are some of the implications of the view that I'm going to express now, the hypothesis of formative causation. To explain why this view is possible and what it is, it's important to begin with the problems from which the theory starts. And these are problems that are in the center of biology. Although this theory has many implications in many areas, for parapsychology, for example, and in many other areas, it doesn't start by considering those questions. It starts with the central problems of biology. And one of the central problems of biology, of our understanding of animals and plants, is to understand how animals and plants take up their form. I mean their shape. When we look at the flower, or a leaf, or a cat, or a rabbit, we see a definite shape or form. And inside the shapes of these animals and plants are many other forms, the forms of the organs and of the tissues and of the cells within those tissues. And then within those cells, organelles and molecules of complicated forms. How do these forms come into being? The organism develops from a fertilized egg, which has very little structure, and as it develops, more and more structure comes into being. And this process of the coming into being of form is called by biologists morphogenesis, which simply means coming into being of form, from the Greek word morphe, form, and genesis, coming into being. Although the problem of morphogenesis, the fact of morphogenesis is completely central, all of us see every day plants and trees and other people. We recognize all these shapes and forms. We take it for granted that when we plant seeds, they grow into trees or flowers. We have to remind ourselves that this process, which we see around us all the time and which we take for granted, is not at all understood in scientific terms. In biology, under the reigning paradigm, which is the mechanistic theory of life or the machine theory of life, the attempt is made to try and explain this process of coming into being of form in terms of molecules and in terms of known kinds of chemical and physical interaction. And we have indeed found out a lot about the molecules of life, including the genetic chemical DNA and the many kinds of proteins which make up living organisms. But these discoveries of molecular biology have not led to an understanding of the coming into being of form. They've given us much more detailed knowledge about what happens when form comes into being, but they haven't explained it. And one way of stating the problem is to think about our own bodies. The DNA in all the cells of our bodies is the same. We have identical copies of the genetic material in all our cells. And yet the shape of our arms and our legs is different. And our arms and our legs contain the same proteins, the same muscle proteins, the same nerve proteins, the same blood proteins, and so forth. With the same chemicals, different forms appear. And of course, different organs like the eye and the ear and the liver and the kidney have different chemicals from the arm and the leg. Many of them are different. But the problem is, you see, that the chemicals alone do not explain the form. It's like in architecture. If we are trying to study houses or buildings, then we can't understand the form of the building just by analysing the bricks and the mortar and the wood that is put into the building. And the same bricks and mortar and wood could give buildings of different forms. So the form of the building is not explained by the chemicals in it. In thinking about this problem, one way of trying to understand morphogenesis that's been put forward by biologists, by embryologists and developmental biologists, is the idea of morphogenetic fields. This idea was first put forward in 1922, and it's an idea that the growing organism is shaped or molded by form-shaping fields. The idea of these fields was obtained in the first place by analogy with the known fields of physics, like the magnetic field. Around a magnet, there is a field which we can't see or touch or smell or taste or hear, but we can reveal its presence by sprinkling iron filings around the magnet, and then we see a pattern that tells us something about the field which is around the magnet. The idea was that just as magnets have fields around them, so developing organisms have invisible molds, invisible fields which shape or mold their development. And these invisible molds control the form of the organism. So the egg of the organism becomes associated with the morphogenetic field of that species, and this field shapes the development of the embryo, and then subsidiary fields for the arms and the legs shape those, and within those are other fields which shape the development of the fingers and the fingernails and the bones and so on. So there's a whole hierarchy of form-shaping fields involved in the development of the organism. This concept helped in understanding some of the central problems of embryology, which I can illustrate by the first slide. First slide, please. This slide shows on the left the normal egg of a dragonfly, and in it has developed a dragonfly embryo. On the right, the egg was tied by a small thread, and part of it was killed. So we only have half of the egg left, the back half. But instead of giving rise just to the back half of an embryo, which it would have done in the normal egg, it now gives rise to a small but complete embryo. So somehow, from part of the egg, we get a whole organism. And somehow the organism has been able to adjust to this damage and give a whole in spite of this damage. Now, the next slide shows another example of this kind of process. And this is regeneration. Everybody here is familiar with regeneration in plants. We can cut a small part from a plant and put it in the soil, and it will grow into a plant if we're lucky. And we can, from one tree, we can make thousands of trees, each of them growing from a small part of a tree. So the part can give rise to a new whole. This is one of the reasons for thinking in biology that the whole is more than the sum of the parts, because we can take parts away and the whole remains, and we can take parts which themselves become wholes. It's a very mysterious property which has baffled biologists for a long time and is one of the problems that any theory of biology has to deal with. Here is an example of regeneration from an animal, from a newt. In this, this is the eye of a newt, and the lens has been removed from the eye. And when the lens has been removed, what happens is that a new lens is formed from the edge of the iris of the eye. In other words, the lens is regenerated, and the eye comes back to a condition of wholeness again after removal of a part. The way in which the lens is formed in the normal embryo is quite different. It's formed by folding in of the outside skin of the embryo, not from the edge of the iris. And this is a kind of damage which would never occur in nature, because in nature we wouldn't expect to find experimental zoologists going around cutting out lenses with a scalpel. So this is a striking example of regeneration. There are thousands of others. You can cut up flatworms into small pieces and each will give a new worm. The idea of morphogenetic fields was put forward to try and deal with this kind of problem. We could have the lights on there and the slide off. The idea is, you see, that if the field is associated with the system that you damage, then the regeneration is possible because the field is still there and can guide the system to the final form, to the whole form, even though you've taken part of it away. And you see, one of the properties of fields is that they have this kind of wholeness. If you think again of the magnet analogy, if you cut a magnet into two halves, you don't get two half magnets, you get two whole magnets. Small ones, but complete. And each whole magnet has a complete magnetic field around it. You can't cut a slice out of the field and take it away. The field is a whole. And this is the idea, you see, of morphogenetic fields, that they're these form-shaping things which are wholes. This is the idea that was put forward first in 1922 by Alexander Gervich, a Russian. And it was then developed further here in Austria in the 1920s. The idea of morphogenetic fields, though, has not really undergone much development since then. Many biologists have accepted the idea of morphogenetic fields and used the term, but the question of what these fields are or how they work has remained very obscure. Quite a lot of biologists would say, oh well, the morphogenetic field is just a way of talking about complicated physical and chemical interactions of a kind which are not yet fully understood. And this would essentially be the mechanistic view. It would be saying the same thing as the ordinary mechanistic model. So most biologists have, this view was originally started as a radical departure from orthodox biology. And for most people, it's collapsed back into the orthodox view. The idea that everything will be understood in due course just in terms of molecules and electricity and other known physical factors. There are other people who've taken the view that these morphogenetic fields are more than that, and some people have explicitly adopted the idea that they represent platonic archetypes or forms, that they're somehow metaphysical realities, the shapes or forms of all living creatures that are changeless in time. This is a kind of platonic model. Not many biologists support this view, but some do. They usually do so secretly. But there are those who actually are very keen on this view of them, of morphogenetic fields. The view I'm going to put forward is quite different. I've said all this so far to give you the background to what I'm going to say, to the hypothesis I'm putting forward. This, so far, what I've done is summarize some of the developments in biology over the last 60 years. The point where my own hypothesis starts is now in dealing with a third way of thinking of morphogenetic fields. I'm suggesting that these fields are real, that they are a new kind of field. They're not the same as magnetic or electrical fields. They're not just a way of talking about known kinds of interaction between parts of organisms. But there's a new kind of field which has so far not been considered by science. And that these fields have forms or shapes. The field of a rose must be rose-shaped, as it were, and the field of a dog must be related to the shape of a dog. And there must be many, many kinds of fields for all the different kinds of animals and plants, different species. So if each of these fields is going to shape the developing organism, if it is going to mold or shape the developing organism, the field of that particular species must itself have a shape or structure. Where does it get that structure from? The answer I'm suggesting is that the shape or structure of the morphogenetic field is derived from the actual forms of previous members of the species. So that the field shaping a cat, the cat morphogenetic field, is a kind of composite of the actual forms of previous cats, that these forms act upon the developing cat by a kind of action at a distance through space and time, not by being coded in the DNA, but by direct influence from the actual forms of past cats. and that the morphogenetic field represents, as it were, a memory of the species, a pooled or collective memory, and that every member of the species is shaped by its characteristic morphogenetic field, the field of its species, and in turn, what it does, the form it takes, will influence this morphogenetic field, feed back into this field, and shape and mold future members of its species. This is not an easy concept to grasp, because it's very unlike the kinds of ideas we're usually brought up with. And I'm going to spend some more time now trying to explain it more clearly, and giving examples of it, and giving examples of how it can be tested. First, I'll show a diagram to illustrate this process. This diagram represents, in a very crude and simple way, the build-up of influence with time. Every kind of form, every kind of animal or plant comes into being in time, and there's always a first one of that kind. Now, this theory doesn't explain where the first one comes from. This one, I'll deal with that question later. But what the theory does do is talk about when there is a new pattern that comes into being in the world, how that pattern will be repeated, why it will, the way in which it will tend to happen again. And the second time this kind of system comes into being, it will be influenced by the first example. The third time by the first and second. The fourth time by the first, second, and third, and so on. So there will be a cumulative influence. I'm suggesting that this influence doesn't die out with time, nor is it blocked by distance in space, so that as the number of members of a species increases, the morphogenetic field will become stronger, more intense, through repetition. The more something happens, the more likely it will be to happen again. Now, since the members of the species are not exactly the same as each other, but only similar, the morphogenetic field which bears their influence will have a kind of composite of previous members of the species. It won't give a definite form, it will give an average form, which will be defined in terms of probability, not in terms of sharp boundaries. One way of thinking about this, an analogy for this process, is provided by by composite photographs. And the next slide shows an example. Can we lower it slightly? That's fine. This shows an example of composite photographs. These were made 100 years ago in England by Francis Galton, a cousin of Charles Darwin's, who was interested in average forms. On the top, you see three sisters. On the bottom, you see the same three sisters in profile from the side. You could raise it up a bit to see. In the middle, you see average sisters produced by superimposing the three images, giving a third of the normal exposure to each. And so what results is a kind of average face. This is an average of only three. But the process can be continued, and the next slide shows further examples. At the top, we have examples of average officers on the left, and on the right, average private soldiers from the British Army. Francis Galton was very interested in finding out whether there was a distinct racial officer type. Many Englishmen at that time were interested in that question. The main difference seems to be that more officers had moustaches. At the bottom, there are some modern composite photographs. On the left, 30 female scientists, and on the right, 45 male scientists from the John Innes Research Institute in England. So you see, if you look at the face on the right, there are 45 men's faces there. The individual differences have been cancelled out. The common features have been reinforced. And the shape of the face is defined by this kind of probability distribution that we get here. So we have a kind of average form. Now, if we could see morphogenetic fields, I think they would look like that. They would have fuzzy edges. They were not sharply defined. They work in terms of probability, not in terms of exact causation. And this is important because I believe that the way in which they work is ultimately, in terms of modern physics, the way in which they make contact with modern physics would be by influencing probabilistic processes at the quantum level. The next slide shows how morphogenetic fields are organized. On the left, you have a typical hierarchy diagram. On the right is a better representation, where you have what we could call a nested hierarchy, or nested layers of organization. We could think of the outer one as the organism, the next circles as the organs, and the ones inside them as the tissues. Then inside those would be cells, and organelles, and protein molecules, and so forth, and then down to atoms and subatomic particles. So morphogenetic fields include other morphogenetic fields, and I think they act upon the systems under their control by influencing the fields and the probabilities of events at the lower level system. I can't go more into detail as to how they might work now. I try to discuss it in more detail in my book. But I'll have to move on now to the question of how such what this kind of theory actually means. We could switch that off now. So far, I've been talking about this in an abstract way, just as a theory, and that's all it is. It's only a theory, one way of looking at the world, or some of the things in the world. But in science, it's important with theories to see what the consequences are, and then to find out how these consequences can be tested, how we can actually find out whether this is a right theory or a wrong theory, or if it's partly right or partly wrong. And to do this, we have to think of the consequences and the kinds of expectations and the kinds of experiments that could be done to test it. I'll now mention one or two of the ways it could be tested by experiment. First, this theory does not apply just to living organisms. It also applies to the forms of crystals, molecules, and atoms. So, what I'm suggesting is that even in the realm of chemistry, these kinds of fields should be operating. If we consider the form of a crystal, and I'm now talking about the lattice structure of the crystal, the way in which the molecules are arranged, there are reasons for thinking that this form is not uniquely determined by known kinds of energetic causation. And what I think is happening is that when a new compound is made, if we think of a new chemical that has never been made before, chemists make these chemicals all the time in drug companies and in other parts of industry and in universities, that the first time the chemical is made, there won't be a morphogenetic field for the crystals, because there won't have been any crystals of that kind before. It may be very difficult to crystallize that compound the first time. You may have to wait for a morphogenetic field to come into being, however they come into being. But after the compound has been crystallized once, then it should be slightly easier to crystallize it all over the world the second time, because it will be influenced by the first crystal's morphogenetic field. And the third time it should be a little easier still, and the fourth time easier still. So it should become easier to crystallize compounds all over the world as time goes on. Is this a fact? The answer is, it is. It's a well-known fact to chemists that new compounds are difficult to crystallize, and that as time goes on, they get more and more difficult, more and more easy to crystallize all over the world. This has been observed countless times. Many chemists have found this from their own experience, and it's generally accepted among chemists that this happens. But what is the explanation? One explanation is that people learn how to do it from other chemists, and this is, of course, possible, and it's part of it. The more popular explanation among chemists, in addition to the one of knowledge, is a quite extraordinary explanation, and it's based on the idea that the chemicals crystallize more quickly because parts of the previous crystals are carried around the world on the clothing, or more especially the beards, of migrant chemists. And so the idea is that these fragments of crystals are carried around the world by migrant chemists, and then they fall from their beards into crystallizing dishes in other laboratories and speed up the crystallization. And many chemists will tell you stories about this. If any of you have friends who are chemists, you needn't tell them why you're asking, but ask them about crystallization. Try the experiment for yourself, and I guarantee that in the majority of cases you will hear a story about a bearded chemist. But this is part of the folklore of chemistry. It's a really difficult part of chemistry that's not well understood, how you get crystals. And it's not rigorously treated in textbooks. It exists as a kind of folklore in the minds of chemists, and they will talk about it informally. But it's an area which is a very interesting area, but not really part of the formal structure of chemistry textbooks. Now, this is very interesting from the point of view of the hypothesis I'm suggesting, because the facts are ones which fit with this hypothesis. The existing explanations are not terribly convincing and have never been tested. So here's an area where we could set up rigorous tests, where sealed containers could be made, placed in different parts of the world, where the rates of crystallization of a new chemical could be studied at different times. Bearded chemists could be excluded from the laboratory. The other explanation is that minute parts of the crystals get into the air and travel all over the world as microscopic, invisible dust particles. So we can filter dust particles out of the air to make sure there aren't any of those, and find out whether this rate of crystallization really does increase the rate of initiation of crystallization from a supersaturated solution under standard conditions. So this is a possible test. It hasn't been done, but it could be done. There are many possible tests in the realm of form and the inheritance of form. I discuss some of these in my book. They're slightly technical to explain, and so there won't be time to talk about them now. I'll be very happy to discuss any of these things in further detail at the technical seminars, which are scheduled to be held on Saturday. I shall move now to the kinds of tests that could be done in the realm of behavior, right from the other end of the spectrum of crystals, moving to behavior. And I think that the same kinds of principles, these formative fields, should apply to the control of behavior. I'm suggesting that the inherited behavior of animals, the instincts of animals, are coded or are brought about by these kinds of influences from the past, by this process of influence of like upon like, the process I call morphic resonance. So this should apply to behavior as well. And one prediction of this theory is that if you train animals to learn something new in one part of the world, then it should be easier for animals all over the world to learn the same thing more quickly. So if we train rats to learn a new trick here in Austria, then rats in New York and in Australia and in Africa should all be able to learn more quickly because these rats have been trained here, just without any known kind of communication. Not because we telephone and we say we've found out how to train the rats. Not so that we take rats from here to there so they can show the other rats how to do it. Without all that kind of connection, they should just learn quicker. That is a prediction of the theory. And you see, this makes it clear how very radical this theory is and how very different it is from our current mechanistic theory in biology. Again, this is something that can be tested. In fact, it has been tested. People have been studying the behavior of rats for a long time, and they've been observing the rate at which they learn new tricks. And I've been through this large literature on rat psychology, and where this kind of effect does seem to have occurred. Now, I'm not saying this is conclusive evidence for the theory, because one can always think of other explanations, but I'm just saying that when we look for this evidence, we find that there are things that point in this direction. I'll just give one example of this kind of evidence, which comes from some experiments on rats conducted between 1920 and 1954. The experiments were started at Harvard by McDougall, who was the professor of psychology. He was training rats to escape from a maze of water. And the first generations of rats learned very slowly. If they did it wrongly, unfortunately, they received an electric shock. And this is the usual kind of experiment that people do with rats, you see. They received an electric shock, and many of them received hundreds of electric shocks before they learned that they were going out of the wrong exit. He bred from these rats. He took these rats as parents and then took their children and tested them. They learned quicker. The next generation learned quicker still. And he thought that he was providing evidence for the inheritance of acquired characteristics, the Lamarckian theory of inheritance, which of course was defended in this country by Paul Kammerer, and which was a very controversial theory of inheritance at that time during the 1920s. The experiments were very severely criticized by opponents, and McDougall had to answer their criticisms by tightening up his experimental techniques, by doing the experiments more rigorously. He was able to answer all these criticisms. And the most common of these criticisms was that he must have been breeding from the most intelligent rats, that he was selecting the cleverest rats and breeding only from those. And he said, no, that wasn't true. He selected the rats at random as parents of the next generation before they were tested. He didn't even know if they were bright or not when he selected them. Then his critics said, well, there must still have been some subtle selection going on. The stupid rats would have got more electric shocks. Therefore, they would have been weaker. Therefore, they wouldn't have been so good at having children. Therefore, they would have had fewer baby rats. Therefore, there would have been a selective advantage, selection in favor of intelligent rats. So he repeated his experiment, and in the second experiment, he actually selected the parents after they had been tested. He selected the slowest learning rats as the parents of the next generation. So any stupid rats were chosen as parents of the next generation. And the next slide shows the results of this experiment. On the left is the average number of errors. So a decrease in the number of errors means an increase in the rate of learning. On the bottom is the number of generations. So you see, the first generation made about 250 errors on average before learning to go out of the right exit. The last one, the 22nd generation, was making an average of about 25 errors. So it was an increase in learning of 10 times increase in the rate of learning. This was the opposite of what would have been expected on the normal genetic theory, because with selection for stupid rats, they should have got slower, not faster, at learning. His critics were unable to fault this experiment, so they had no alternative but to repeat it. And one of them, Crewe, in Edinburgh, got rats that were exactly the same as McDougall's rats, built water maze exactly the same as McDougall's, did everything exactly the same as McDougall. He started after McDougall had finished. And the very first generation of his rats started off with an average of about 25 errors. Some of them got it right first time. So Crewe gave up. He couldn't explain this, why his were learning so quickly, and neither could McDougall. The next experiment was done in Australia by Agar at the University of Melbourne, and he changed the conditions slightly, and his rats still learned quicker than McDougall's first generation, not quite as quickly as Crewe's. He carried it on for 50 generations. It took him 25 years to do this experiment. He found that, just as McDougall had found, rats got better and better in subsequent generations. There was an improvement in the rate of learning. But he also checked the rate of learning in rats which were not descended from trained parents, just from ordinary rats of that breed, which were completely unrelated to the ones tested, that had not been had fathers or mothers or grandparents that had been tested. He found that those were also getting better, just as well as the others, and that this increase in the rate of learning was spreading through all rats of this kind. So here is an effect of the kind that this hypothesis is predicting. The data are here. This is one of the longest series of experiments in the annals of rat psychology. And I've found various other examples of this kind of phenomenon in the literature. Now, conventional biologists obviously are not going to be convinced by this evidence, because they'll say, oh, well, there must be other explanations. It could have been the experimenters getting better at doing the experiments and all that. That's perfectly possible. I'm not saying mine is the only interpretation. I am saying, though, that this evidence is suggestive and very interesting from the point of view of this hypothesis, and that it suggests that it would be worth doing rigorous tests using animal behavior like rats to test this theory. It's possible to design experiments which would give clear results, I believe. The same kind of thing should also be happening with people. I would imagine that it should be getting easier for children to learn to ride bicycles, for example, over the last 100 years, because millions of people have done it. Apparently, children are, on average, learning bicycle riding quicker. But again, of course, there are other explanations: better bicycles, more psychological motivation, better teaching methods, and all that kind of thing. So it's difficult to get clear results. But in every place where I've looked for evidence for this theory, where it makes predictions, the facts fit it very well. So I'm just saying that it doesn't seem to be too outrageous when we actually look at the facts. It leads to a quite new view of heredity. The usual view is that inheritance depends almost entirely on information coded in DNA, the genetic chemical. And this is supposed to code all the information necessary for an organism to be formed and for the instincts of an animal, for the inherited behavior of an animal, and so on. It's obvious that DNA and the genetic chemical is important in heredity, and the advances in genetics have shown that differences in DNA can lead to hereditary differences in organisms. I'm suggesting that the form and organization of organisms is inherited directly from past members of their species by morphic resonance. So how does these two views of heredity fit together? They seem to be in conflict at first. When we look more closely, we see that they're not in conflict. They're complementary views of understanding inheritance. And the best way to understand this is to think of the analogy of a television set. You have to imagine yourself in the position of somebody who doesn't understand television, who doesn't know how television works. You see a television set, there are pictures on the screen, you see small people talking, or dancing, or making music. If you don't understand the television set, the first and most obvious hypothesis is that inside the set there are some small people whose shadows you are seeing on the screen. And some children think this. You can check that theory by looking inside the set. When you look inside the set, you don't see any small people. So you could then say, well, the people must be very small, microscopic, inside the wires. So you then look inside the wires and you still can't see any small people. So then you can say, well, they're very small indeed, below the limits of detection of the microscope. Or you could put forward a more sophisticated hypothesis. You could say the small people arise on the screen of the television set as a result of complicated interactions between all these different parts of the set, transistors, wires, condensers, and all that. It also depends on the energy coming into the set. You take the plug out of the wall and the set stops, put it back in again, the pictures come again. So you've discovered that and you take wires out and the pictures disappear, you put the same wires back and the pictures will reappear. So you could think, well, here the pictures are arising out of complicated interactions among the parts of the set. These parts are made of ordinary chemicals like copper and silicon. We can analyze these chemicals. There's nothing mysterious about these chemicals at all. They're regular chemicals. And they're arranged in a particular way, and they're interacting with each other in particular complicated ways that aren't yet fully understood. And given time, although we don't fully understand it at present, in terms of ordinary reactions, we will, in 50 years or 20 years, be able to explain the pictures in terms of complicated interactions between the parts, which are not yet fully understood. That, I think, is the position of conventional mechanistic biology. And what I'm suggesting, if you said to such a person, well, actually, there are these influences coming from outside the set, invisible influences, we can't see them or touch them or detect them with our senses, but they're coming into the set, and the pictures of the people are coming from outside and are coming into the set. You see, it could easily be dismissed. This is a very vague theory, he might say, very vague theory. There's no evidence for these influences. This is just mysticism or something like that. However, your idea might be tested seriously. You might say, well, if it's something, it must weigh something, because nothing exists if we can't measure it. So we weigh the set switched on, we weigh it switched off, and the weight is the same. So this proves that nothing is coming into the set from outside, and it's all happening just from the inside. Very convincing, you see, but wrong. Not entirely wrong, because all the components of the set are important, but so are the transmissions to which it's tuned, these invisible fields which the set is picking up. What I'm suggesting happens in heredity is that the organism, the fertilized egg, already has a structure, and that structure depends on its genes. And as it develops, the kinds of proteins it makes can depend on its genetic inheritance. That these proteins and the DNA and the chemicals are like the wires and the transistors of the set. They're the building blocks of the set. If you change one of the wires or change the value of a condenser or a resistance, you will change the pictures you get on the screen. So changes in the hereditary material will affect the tuning of the set and will affect the quality of the pictures. But the pictures themselves are not coded in that information. So I think the DNA is setting up the tuning system, the chemicals that make up the tuning system of the set. And the actual organization of the form and behavior is coming through morphic resonance, by this kind of collective species memory. So DNA has an important role in heredity. What I'm saying is not at all in conflict with the evidence for genetic factors in inheritance. And in fact, the two ideas are completely complementary. We know what DNA does, actually. It codes for the sequence of amino acids in proteins. And some of it's involved in controlling protein synthesis. But that's all. And that may be all it does. And the other kinds of organization depend on morphogenetic fields. So this leads to a very new view of heredity. And it also, because of the new view of heredity, leads to a new view of evolution. Because the current theory of evolution is based on the Mendelian theory of inheritance, on the genetic theory of inheritance. And if that's wrong or too limited, and if inheritance involves a kind of collective memory, well, then possibilities exist like the inheritance of acquired characteristics, not just by the offspring of parents that have learned something new, but by all the members of the species, potentially. It goes far further than the Lamarckian theory of inheritance. And it also makes possible a kind of connection between different species. It's possible that one species in one part of the world could pick up morphogenetic fields from another species in another part of the world, and similar structures could appear in quite different organisms that are separated by an enormous distance, or possibly even by an enormous time. Features of extinct organisms could turn up again. Such things are known from the fossil record and from the study of monsters, and are usually called atavisms, reversions, or throwbacks. One of the most radical implications of this theory is in relation to memory. I can't go into this in detail, I shall just outline it briefly. Again, I have to say that There won't be time for questions today, but we'll have to take up these points in the technical seminars. We can take any of these points up later. So I'm sorry I have to move so fast. When we think of what morphic resonance is supposed to do, what I'm suggesting is that organisms are influenced by similar organisms in the past by this process of morphic resonance, and that the specificity of the resonance is greater if the organisms are more similar. So the greater the similarity, the more powerful and effective the morphic resonance. Now we can ask, what is the organism most similar to any given organism in the past, to ourselves, for example? What living organism is more similar to me in the past than any other organism? The answer is myself. We are more similar to ourselves in the past and more similar to ourselves in the immediate past than we are to any other organism. Any organism is more similar to itself, any system, any crystal, than any atom, any molecule, is more similar to itself in the immediate past than to any other system. The morphic resonance acting upon it will be mostly that from its own past. This will be the most specific morphic resonance. This, I think, will help to explain how the form of a system tends to be quite stable through time, even though the matter, the actual material constituents, are changing. Our chemicals are changing. Every day we eat new food and we lose and excrete other chemicals. But our forms remain more or less the same. So at the level of form, this process of self-resonance, resonance with one's own past states, will help to conserve and maintain form. At the level of behavior, this self-resonance will mean that there will be direct influences from one's own past states on one's present state. If one has learned something in the past, if one's done something many times, like riding a bicycle, for example, all those things will influence the present time one's riding the bicycle. And the memory of that habit is not something that need be stored inside the brain. It may come directly from the past by morphic resonance. What I'm suggesting, you see, is that memories need not be stored inside the brain. Our brains may be more like tuning systems than memory storage devices. If part of the tuning system is damaged, then we may not be able to gain access to some memories. If we cut a part out of a TV set, we may lose the ability to tune into one channel or to another channel. This doesn't prove that the information that in those channels is coded or carried inside the part of the TV set we have cut out. If we lose memories after brain damage, it doesn't prove the memories are stored inside that part of the brain that is damaged. If memories are evoked by stimulation of a part of the brain, it doesn't prove that they're stored inside the part stimulated, because we may stimulate a part of a TV set, it may jump onto another channel. We may start getting a different set of pictures from another broadcasting station. It doesn't prove that the part we've been stimulating electrically is carrying that information. In fact, the question of memory is very mysterious. There are many different theories of memory in conventional biology. One is that memories are stored as chemical molecules inside the brain, RNA, for example. That's going out of favor. Another is that there are changes in the nerve endings, which may be distributed all over the brain. Another is that there are reverberating circuits of electrical activity. But the problem with memory is extremely mysterious. And we all take it for granted, but it's one of the things which is certainly not solved by existing biology. So what I'm suggesting to you is that this question of memory is completely open. There is no evidence that memories are stored inside the brain at all. And we normally assume they are because of our general materialist or mechanist assumptions. It's taken for granted in our culture that they must be stored inside the brain. How else could it work? But this is very much something that can be questioned. Actually, it has been questioned over the centuries by many philosophers. So this whole question of memory has been recognized as a problem for at least 2,000 years, probably longer. And it's still a problem. I'm not saying that my explanation is the correct one, but I'm saying it's a possible one. And the conventional one is also possible, but not proved. So this is an open question. Now, if memories are not stored inside the brain, And we pick up our own memories from the past by tuning into our own past states. Why don't we pick up other people's memories as well? We are, of course, similar to other people in many ways, not as similar as we are to ourselves. But against the background of our own personal memories, you see, there could be a general tuning into a kind of pooled memory of the species, a collective memory. And in that collective memory, we wouldn't expect specific details. We would expect sort of composites. Particular kinds of experience or perception would be experienced as composites. The individual details would be removed, but the general pattern would be what would be reinforced in the collective memory. We would in fact get something very similar to the idea of the archetypes in the collective unconscious that Jung spoke of. And in fact, I think that this view leads naturally into the kind of view that Jung was putting forward about the collective unconscious, which he thought of as a kind of memory. He even spoke in terms of the, when he was talking about the mother archetype, for example, he talked of this as the composite, actually used the word composite, of countless past experiences of mothers. And so there'd be this kind of archetype which would be based on a composite of experience, like those composite photographs where the general features were present but the individual details were removed. So here again, this hypothesis leads to a prediction which seems to fit quite well with the facts, because Jung and his psychoanalysts of his school have got quite persuasive evidence, I believe, for the existence of a collective unconscious from the study of dreams and myths and so forth. Second, is it possible, if we tune normally into our own memories, if we tune into someone else's memory, a particular person, and that memory was of very recent origin, say it was something that happened 1 second ago, we would have something that was very similar to, that amounted to instantaneous or immediate thought transference, or telepathy. Third, it might be possible sometimes to tune in to memories of particular people who are now dead, in which case one would have a phenomenon of memories of past lives. There is in fact evidence from case studies of children and some not so reliable evidence from hypnotic regression that such memories may exist. This is, of course, very disputed, this evidence, but again, here's a prediction which seems to be in accordance with at least a possible range of facts. Fourthly, if memories are not stored inside the brain, it's possible to think in terms about the survival of bodily death in a quite different way from the way we have to think about it in terms of the existing mechanistic model. According to the conventional theories in biology, memories are stored inside the brain. There are differences of opinion, as I've said, about how they're stored, but it's usually assumed they are stored inside the brain. Therefore, when we die, our brains decay. There's no possibility of any of these memories surviving in any form, except, of course, other people remembering us and that kind of thing. So if memories are stored inside the brain, it's not possible to have reincarnation or any kind of survival of bodily death. These things are an important part of all world religions. It may be an illusion to believe that we survive after death, but the reason that the question of survival is usually dismissed by materialists and, of course, by dogmatic atheists is that memories are stored inside the brain, therefore there can't be any survival. It's a very strong argument, and if memories are stored inside the brain, then I think it completely rules out almost all traditional religious views of survival. And for the atheist, this is a very important point. He thinks that there is good evidence for ruling out all religious beliefs of this kind on the assumption that memories are stored inside the brain. If they're not stored inside the brain, the question becomes open. I'm not saying that this can possibly prove that there's any kind of conscious survival. Any kind of conscious survival of bodily death. But at least it leaves that possibility open, which, and the conventional view does not. So this is a very important and interesting question, this whole question of memory. Now, I have to end by saying that this hypothesis is essentially a hypothesis of repetition. It explains how once things have happened, they are repeated. It, in its most general form, it would lead us to think of the laws of nature as more like habits, as I said at the beginning. It would say what's happened is likely to condition or influence what happens now. What happens now will condition or influence what happens in the future. So this is one of the implications of the theory. It explains and deals with repetition. More often things are repeated, the more likely they will be to happen again, other things being equal. And so it talks about habits. It does not explain creativity. It does not explain how the first of any kind of thing came into being, how the first dinosaur or the first cat or the first idea of Sir Isaac Newton's, for that matter, or the first symphony of Mozart's came into being, how any creative act takes place. This theory cannot explain. It only explains or deals with repetition. The question of creativity is something that has to be left open. I don't myself believe that it lies within the province of natural science to explain creativity. Science is concerned with the study of the regularities of nature, with things that are repetitive and regular up to a point. Creativity is something that involves the intrusion of the new, something that's an innovation which is not to be explained in terms of what has gone before. There are several ways of understanding creativity, and those I have to leave open also. The materialist will always say that creativity ultimately takes place as a result of chance, because for the materialist there's nothing beside the laws of nature and matter and chance in the universe. So chance will be the ultimate explanation for the materialist. For the pantheist or the animist, it would be the idea of a creative factor, a guiding intelligence within nature, or hierarchies of guiding intelligences within nature, which would be responsible for the creativity of the evolutionary process. For the theist, the creativity within nature would depend ultimately on the creative ground of nature itself. So this question can only be left open, and it's an atheist or a theist could have their own views about creativity, but both together could work in the laboratory studying the ways in which morphic resonance might or might not occur. So this view, this hypothesis can be seen within different metaphysical overviews. The hypothesis is only a hypothesis. It's a possibility, which I'm suggesting. It's something that can be tested by experiment. Some experiments have already begun to test it. There's even a competition being set up where a prize is being offered for to encourage tests and investigations of this hypothesis. And this process is now underway. It will be several years, probably, before we know the answer. But I hope that there will be some answer that will show whether this is along the right lines or not. If it is, the implications for physics, biology, and psychology will be very far-reaching indeed. And I think that this would help towards the development of a truly holistic and view which can really go beyond the mechanistic view of nature. Whether this is the right way to go or not, we still don't know. But this is a possibility, and I offer it for your consideration. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.